On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a ratio. Okay, though. It's a ratio. Okay, though.
When I said to my family that I knew better what I wanted to do in my life, you know, I got kicked, to the curb, you know. So go outside and go, you know, be a boxer or stay here in Africa. You can, you know, there's plenty of people to box here. And obviously Paris was the capital and where everything that was that had to do with entertainment, was happening. So I went to Paris.
But you had nothing going on.
Well, obviously, I knew nobody in Paris. And so I spent about a year in Paris until this amazing fashion designer, Thierry Mugler, I was sent to meet. I met his assistant, and immediately it was like, wait, put this on. I'll be back. And ran with my book. Couple photos were just in this portfolio, and came back and said, okay, put this on, come with me. Took me to see Thierry Mugler, and Thierry Mugler is in the room with a few other people, and they're just braving how he was looking for somebody like me, and here I come, wow, this, and we're doing this trip, and we're doing that trip, and we're going here with Iman, Katusha, you know, all those great top models back then. That was that.
Jaimin Hansu is one of the great actors of our time because he's got this deep, quiet, burning intensity inside him that I love to watch. This man was homeless in Paris at one point of his life, and now he's shining. He's one of the stars of A Quiet Place Part 2. An intense new movie that's just dropping. So check it out. It's Jaimin Hansu on Touré Show. I mean, you have always been this actor who just sort of like just burns through the celluloid. And like just has all this presence.
Oh,
and you
wow,
just
thank
stand
you.
Out so much, just even just walking down the street. How do you do that?
I don't know if it's something you do necessarily. I'm a little bit speechless, but okay, let's move on.
I mean, some people,
I'll come back to that question later.
Some people talk about being in the moment when they're shooting or when they're on stage helps
right.
create some of that level of presence.
Right.
Is it about really pouring yourself into the moment and the character that what I read as...
Yes... It's some of that, but obviously, as you know, the interpretation of that, you know, we are the instrument of interpretation, basically. So therefore, a little bit of it's going to be left in you, and certainly the essence of you going to be left in so many of the characters you play.
Yeah. I mean, I always believe you 100%. Of like you fully are, you know, like you erase the person that I know of.
And yeah, I'm like, and in that moment, I truly believe that I am that person. I am that sort of person, you know, character that I'm, you know, like in Blood Diamond, there was not one moment that I felt like this was not happening to me. Amistad, it's no one moment where I didn't sort of like feel the strength of my ancestors, you know, still resonating, you know, through me portraying that character. And so I would say that some of those characters are culturally and socially strong, you know, extremely relevant to me. So therefore, that speaks of my values, that speaks of my me as a, you know, human being. They define me, those characters.
I imagine in something like Amistad, it would be quite painful to really embrace that and live in that character. He was going through so much.
Well, yeah, of course he was going through so much. Wow. None of us could even imagine or come close to enduring some of those things that they've had to endure. Me today, you know, obviously things are a little bit better, you know. Obviously I'm somewhat doing what I like and somewhat getting compensated for that. So I would say that it would seem like my, you know, life today for some of us a lot better, but you still, in so many areas, you still feel like a second-class citizen, even with a celebrity.
You do, still. Status.
Oh, for sure.
Where?
Even here in New York City sometimes. Because you're coping with people who don't really quite understand yet the importance of, and certainly does not understand that we're all part of a human race. That one race is a human race, not shade race. Yeah. So you feel, you know, you still feel like, you're existing in a world where certain people feel so much more privileged than you are, you know, that they, yeah.
I mean, I definitely know what you feel. Is that about America? Do you feel it in Europe too? Or
extremely
is it
in Europe too. I mean, some of our brothers are playing on, national television, national stages, you know, and being called monkeys.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, please.
Yeah.
In this day and age.
Yeah.
And by the forefathers.
And I feel like you take that weight into your work and into your
because
characters.
Because all that weight is part of weight that we, if you're socially conscious, the weight that you carry.
The dignity that you bring to your characters is partly from that weight. Does it come from that weight? Does it combat that in any way?
It may have resonance in some of those characters that I play. It may have resonance in that, whether I want it or not. Because, again, like I said, you are the instrument of interpretation. Some of you are going to be left in some of the characters you play. You know, because at the end of the day, it's your voice that is used and your likeness that is used for the interpretation.
I mean, think about the way that even Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte helped Americans see the beauty and dignity of a black man and chip away just a teeny bit at some of it. Is that something that you think you're able to do to present?
Oh, for sure. Well, I'm trying, and obviously you're challenged on a regular basis. I mean, again, you know, I live in a world that I'm... You know, somebody obviously signs my check. Well, let me put it this way. So you're offered certain roles, and the roles obviously you had to remember that from beginning of time we were not considered as people. So the roles you play now, the roles that are kind of you're tolerated. You're tolerated to be considered human sometimes.
Do you think it's the same for us? Because I feel like I feel what you're saying, but do you feel like as an African-American, I have a privilege or a position that an African may not enjoy? Do you think you're being looked at differently as an African versus an African-American?
For sure. Are you asking me if African-Americans look at me differently?
No, I'm saying all people, black and white.
For sure.
Look at you differently than me.
Yes.
How so?
Because Africans are probably the most disrespected race, in the whole idea of human race. They're the most disrespected human being. And you're by African-Americans as well. I'm just trying to be honest.
Yeah.
But because you don't, you have lost connection.
Yeah,
we have lost touch. We have lost touch. We have lost connection with one another, right? And so, therefore, you sort of don't really see yourself as part of me anymore.
I do.
Well, I mean, well, yeah,
some
you
don't,
do.
But
some
I do.
Yeah, some do, and some don't. But I'm saying in general. And this is one of the reasons why I was so compelled to find an instrument for which Africa and the diaspora can somewhat find a connection between, you know, and say, oh, my DNA, you know, because more and more, I mean, like, everybody and anybody who lives in America and who is from America, no matter whether it's first generation or second generation, you're from someplace else.
Yeah.
Your DNA is from someplace else.
Michelle Obama is one of the most inspiring, intelligent, graceful, unapologetically black people that I could think of. Just her existing makes me happy, makes me feel inspired, makes me want to be a little bit more like her every day because she seems to be just this extraordinary person. So if there's any sort of podcast about her, I want to listen to that. Life Kit from NPR has a whole episode on Michelle Obama. It's part of their whole Black Stories, Black Truths collection, where you'll hear stories of Black joy, Black resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today from a unique Black perspective. There's a Code Switch episode about Dr. King, and I love Code Switch. There's It's Been a Minute about Eric Andre, who I love. We are not the same person, even though a lot of people think we look alike, even though he lives in my neighborhood now. But stop telling him he looks like me. Stop telling me I look like him. There's a Pop Culture Happy Hour about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I loved that show. That show meant so much to me. This is what Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR is all about. Stories about Black America and Black culture. Whole Pop Culture Happy Hour on Abbott Elementary, which is another amazing modern Black show. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott to the Color Purple, the stories of Black Stories, Black Truths will take you inside the Black community and Black culture. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Your journey here to being an American superstar is unexpected. It sounds like it would be a movie in and of itself.
Yeah, it is.
How did you get from Benin to France?
I had two brothers. We're five, and I'm the youngest of five. So I had two brothers. The first two oldest brothers that went on an adventure, you know, living in Ivory Coast, you know, from Benin going to Ivory Coast, and from Ivory Coast moved to Paris, ventured to Paris, and end up staying in Paris, both of them, and having a life. And one of them obviously became French. And so, you know, I was the youngest, and they were, most of them all completely grown and, you know, left the house. And so I guess my oldest brother, who was actually doing really well, you know, for himself, you know, at a very young age, thought of, wow, we have a younger brother who is here in Africa. The parents live in Ivory Coast. I'm in Benin. The brothers all lives in France.
Who are you living with?
I'm living with the grandparents and older brother. And so the older brother just thought, oh, well, why don't you go and stay with your other brother to better your education in France, yeah.
How old were you?
I was 12 years old. And so the first time I was sent to France, I mean, needless to say, I was I was deported on the spot. I 12 years old, I arrived in France, Lyon. That was the first time, was Lyon, straight from it was Lyon. So landed in Lyon, and then I was like told I have to go back.
So
they turned me right around the spot and sent me back. And so eventually my family came and got me from the police station and at the airport in Benin. And then a few months later, my brother got another ticket for me. He said, no, you're not staying here. Let's go.
Let's go to Paris.
Yeah, let's go to Paris now. So I came through Paris the second time and stayed.
But it didn't immediately work out as expected.
No, of course not. I mean, of course. I mean, listen, I was, you know, growing up with my, you know, sort of been overseen by my two older brothers. One of them was married with a kid. The other one wasn't. So they both, you know, obviously had a conflict. Who's going to, you know, who am I going to stay with? And so, needless to say, one of them took me in, and he's the one who didn't have a wife or whatever. So he lived in Lyon. So I went back with him in Lyon and lived with in a chambre de bonne, as we say in French. You know, it's pretty much kind of like the maid's room. You know?
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
That's sort of like, it's sort of like this room is almost too big for it. But
little closet.
Two-thirds of this room, pretty much. And we have to go to, he was going to school at a university. So we went to the school and university to shower every day. And yeah. And so that's how I lived for the first, probably 8 years in Lyon.
But you become homeless at some point?
And then, fast forward to, growing up in France and thinking that I knew better. And I thought, well, okay, listen, I know what I'm going to do in life, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And, so I was doing a lot of sports also. So one of my brothers also knew that I was, heavy in boxing. And so we used to have, discussions. And so I used to sometimes contemplate the idea of boxing. And then he just went on. I was fairly good to a point where they wanted to, push me, to go professional. But my brother told the rest of the family, and everybody went off. I mean, like, pissed off. And so I eventually sort of like stepped away from that. But the ultimate dream was always making movies anyways.
Really?
Yeah, since I was 8 years old, probably 8 to 10 years old.
What did you see that made you say, that's for me?
We in Africa, Wednesday afternoon, we midday we leave school, right? It's a half a day, right? So half a day, that Wednesday afternoon is always sort of eventful for us, kids. And we used to collect detergent packages, empty packages that, if you collected five of them, will give you a ticket to a screening, from the theater of the city at the time. That was called Vogue. I remember Vogue would be so packed all the way to the bathrooms, all the way to the street, and you would hear just the sound of the movie. And it was just basically generally cowboy films that they were playing, And so all you could hear, it's the spurs on the shoes, walking, and the shotguns, and those are the things. And then you hear some, American, language spoken, and it was quite cool. And it was we were looking at Gary Cooper, those kind of type of
John Wayne,
those mm-hmm. type of actors, and glorifying America. It was just unbelievable. It was a world apart, And we used to fantasize about that. I think my fantasies came from there.
So I want to be like Gary Cooper and John Wayne.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable, that image of the way the man is shot, also from down looking up, and he just looks so massive, so imposing, with a shotgun on the side. I mean, it was just impressive. It was the Wild Wild West, I guess. But I didn't know it was fast forward to today that I would find myself in America, making movies.
I mean, I grew up watching movies and idolizing those sort of people, and I didn't think, well, I could do that. I thought, my God, these people seem godlike.
Well, I don't know if I really thought about whether I could do that or not do that. I just thought, wow, it's unbelievable to be in movies. And you can pretend being like fully yourself, existing with all. Yeah.
But you were homeless in Paris for a period of time.
Well, when I said to my family that I knew better what I wanted to do in my life, I got kicked, to the curb, So go outside and go, be a boxer, or stay here in Africa. You can, there's plenty of people to box here. And so, mind you, the story is a little bit complex because I was sent back to Africa to sort of answer to my parents. So as I landed, everybody obviously upset, and it was just like the idea was that you're going to stay here, You've, you know, it almost seems like I've committed some crime in Europe, or, you know, so now you're home and we're not, you know, we're not going to tolerate this. We didn't send you there to sort of like have all these crazy fantasies and wanting to be a boxer and wanting to be an actor. Piss off. So I got kicked to the curb. I went back to Paris and sort of found myself, you know, homeless. And then, I went back to Lyon. And then from Lyon, I just said, well, I'm not going to stay in Lyon. Obviously, this is where I grew up, and I certainly don't want to run into some of the friends that I've, you know, gone to school with. So I switched to switched the city, you know. And obviously, Paris was the capital and where everything that was that had to do with entertainment, you know, was happening. So I moved to, I went to Paris.
But you had nothing going on.
Well, obviously, I knew nobody in Paris, and so I spent about a year in Paris until this amazing fashion designer, Thierry Mugler, I was sent to meet, and met his assistant, and immediately it was like, oh, wait, put this on. I'll be back. And ran with my book. A couple of photos were just in this portfolio. And came back and said, okay, put this on. Come with me. Took me to see Thierry Mugler. And Thierry Mugler is in a room with a couple, few other people. And they're just braving how he was looking for somebody like me. And here I come. Wow, this. And we're doing this trip. And we're doing that trip. And we're going here with Iman, Katusha, you know, all those great top models back then. Lauren Scott, bless her soul. Yeah, that was that.
How did you get from Mugler world and modeling into acting?
Oh, into acting. Well, first of all, the modeling was pure accident, so it was acting that I was looking for when I got into modeling, you know. And so from there, I went on a trip with Thierry Mugler to Los Angeles and to a place called Alamo Gordo in New Mexico. And it was an area where we shot some, you know, some photos. It was an amazing place, sand dunes. It was just like an amazing site of a place that is just full of sand dunes, you know, white sand dunes, crystal white. It's beautiful. But anyways, so that was my first time coming to America. And I obviously went to Hollywood and I went to Los Angeles and discovered Hollywood. And I was like, wow. This is where they really make those big movies. What am I wasting my time in France for? And literally, I switched my thinking, switched right then and there, and then I went back to, right after the photos, I went back to Paris for about 2 months, I think, just time to pack myself, and I was back in California trying to pursue acting. Then I realized I didn't speak English, and I was like, oh, dang. I realized I didn't speak English, and I was like, you know, because of the urge and the, and I was so excited to be in America, because, you know, obviously I was looking at Americans, African Americans, these are my people, you know. I was, you know, deeply you know, connected in my mind, you know, and excited, and moved to Hollywood. And then slowly, one of my friends said, well, wait a second. You know, this is one of my model friends from Paris who came to L.A. for a job. And so we were having lunch, and he said, wait a second. So what are you doing here again? So I said to him that I was pursuing acting. I said, acting in America, and you don't speak English? Okay. And then the next day he brought me a book, Hemingway,
Which one?
I forgot what it was down. It's Hemingway about his journey in Europe. I forgot what it's called. Anyways, needless to say that he gave me that book to read and to get acquainted with the language. And I didn't really read it. I sort of started and it started to give me a headache. But, you can imagine what it must have been not speaking English. You're in a country where nobody speaks the language you speak, and you must communicate. You don't know anything, you don't know anybody, and you're just sort of like, it's you and that world. And you must be reborn, right? Because everything you have to, you know, must be learned. So it was a great challenge, you know.
Did you go to classes to learn English?
I wanted to. I joined I think it was called the Fairfax High School for night, night classes. But it seemed a little too slow for me because there were just, you know, a lot of other foreigners who just were still at the stage of you, me, he, and, you know. So I was like, no. I must progress fast, you know, I must be, you know, so
you gotta make
all
it.
I did is just basically, I only did 1 week there and I just thought it was too slow. And so I quit that and just basically spent time watching A&E, Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel. Those were my favorite channel, the History Channel as well. It was great. That was a great, you know, because, they spoke beautifully. And what they spoke about was quite graphically, sort of shown as well. So eventually, between that and reading, just reading newspaper, just reading anything, whether you understood or not, didn't understand, it really didn't matter. Just make the effort of just sitting there for a couple of hours every day, just reading out loud to yourself. And you don't have to understand or comprehend anything about the text. Just read it. Just to get your word, the verb, articulating. And the more you are saying the words, the more you're looking at the documentaries, A&E, Discovery, the Learning Channel. Now, slowly, some of those words are coming back because you're hearing it now in a different context. So your comprehension start to develop.
And now you think in English?
Mostly. And now I think in English before I speak in French.
Interesting.
It's so reverse now.
An amazing long career now leads you to A Quiet Place Part 2,
mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting mm-hmm. piece because so much of it is about working in silence.
Yes.
Right.
It's great.
How's that?
That was quite, amazing for me because, again, I just realized similarly in this story where you're forced to be quiet and where the language here is your physicality mixed with emotions, right? And that's really where I came from because that's sort of like my early days of learning and obviously speaking. English was more to study people, body language and, feeling from what, not so much about what they're saying to you, but what you're getting, the vibe you're getting out of it, you know. And that's sort of like how I start to, develop myself here in the beginning. So this film sort of like mimics that a little bit. But again, the purity of making film, the purity of cinema is really silent films.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So this really, and the essence of this film, speaking of, having such a strong social relevance with, what's going on today. It's quite impacting. I think it's not so much about the creature. I think what we're drawn to, it's the, you know, these people, how they socially, engage with one another in such a tragic, moment.
It seems like a good fit for you because you have this great physicality about you and the way you approach your characters. So to ask you to be more quiet, I would still think, oh, well, he can handle that because the way that he moves on screen is very powerful.
Yeah, but it also, I think, you know, obviously, as you know, there's so much power in silence,
yes.
You know, and that can be so also quite intimidating if you're not used to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a good actor and a great actor?
Oh, wow. Wow. A great actor would oftentimes makes you forget the... make you forget the interpreter.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com. or wherever books are sold.
Makes you forget the interpreter. And depending on what type of, emotionally driven character it is, to make you reflect on your, on your own self, I think, well, but it also, it depends.
When you, quite often you're asked to play Africans, are you generally satisfied?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we not yet showing Africans as complex as they should be?
Oh, we haven't even begun showing Africans as complex as they should be or as they are. No. Mind you, your story have not been told. Your story have not been told. Anything that has been told about you, it's been a bunch of rhetoric to make you look, not you. your story hasn't been told.
We started to talk about this before, but the responsibility that you feel to your ancestors, both familial in Africa and the actors, the black actors who came before you, what is that?
Well, I don't. I can't really tell you. It's specifically tell you what it is, other than. I have kids.
How many?
Right. I have one.
How old?
He's 10, right? And you know, great 10, you know, 10-year boy, but when he was 4, he said something that sort of shocked me, and I never thought that, you know, my kid would say something like that. But, you know, he's been playing for Spider-Man and all those kind of, you know, characters for a long time. And one day he turns around and looks at me and said, man, I wish I was... he said, I wish I was... let me say specifically how he put it. I wish I was, I want to say, he said, white, to climb walls like Spider-Man.
He said, I wish I was white so I could climb walls like Spider-Man?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
Well, that was shocking.
Yeah.
I didn't have a comeback. So immediately what I did was went to the computer and just start searching for anything that has to do with superheroes that were, you know, some with, you know, color superheroes. You know, that was that. And it's funny to me, it was very strange because for since he was born and would start to play with video games, with, you know, watching animations and all that, my sense was like I was feeling like I'm feeding my son a bunch of things that are, that's not necessarily hit home. All of them don't hit home. All of them, he does not see himself through most of them. Do you see what I mean? Until that came out, and I was, shocked. And so then I was making, I think Guardians of the Galaxy with James Gunn. And I told the story to James Gunn, and James Gunn went and asked for somebody to send us a comic book of Spider-Man, but this Spider-Man was black. And come to find out, the original Spider-Man was actually black.
Really?
There's a story about that you might want to check.
What do you want from your career that you haven't gotten yet?
Oh, boy. What do you want? I mean, I guess the ultimate achievement for an actor is, you know, hopefully to... you know, go to the Oscars and for having one of your films been nominated and, you know, of yourself to be nominated and hopefully winning, you know.
Two nominations so far.
Yeah, two nominations so far. And I'm just hoping for the third and hoping to take one home one day. That would be beautiful.
That's the dream.
that is one of the extensions of the dream. But the ultimate dream is to be able to reopen the gate of no return. To be to have the gate of return. And the gate of return is basically the extended souls of Africa being in the diaspora, being Brazil, being Haiti, being Jamaica, being Cuba, for all of them to reconnect with Africa.
Do you want a literal return or you want like a more spiritual reconnection?
Spiritual reconnection.
For us to feel the diaspora.
It's not just for us to feel the diaspora. It's for us to reconnect, visceral reconnection with the diaspora, meaning whether it's you, for you to feel like, oh, I feel so alive, I want to move back to Africa, it's up to you. Matter of fact, you can move wherever you want to move to. It doesn't necessarily have to be Africa. It doesn't have to be necessarily Europe or, you know, you see what I mean? But it's the visceral reconnection with your DNA. And your DNA is in Africa, not anywhere else.
Right.
Yeah.
So you want black people everywhere to feel and know.
And know
Africa
that you are
is
and
my
know,
home.
Africa is your home, and Africa is still your home. And your roots.
How do you do that?
I've put this cultural sports event together called the Ghetto Return, the Ghetto Return Marathon and Festival. For which, I believe humanity oftentimes come around sports events and music, right? And so the idea is to have this sports event, a marathon in which people can run, people can walk it. You can be young and you can be old and you can still run a marathon. You know, it doesn't really matter. Or you can walk it. Or you can symbolically just show up. So, for the triumph over slavery, it is the idea. And to heal the wound of slavery, that's the idea. You know? And so, the sports marathon, it comes with a 2-day festival in which we, celebrate the intergenerational of our African identity. We celebrate our DNA. We celebrate our, African connection with, whether to be musically, had to do with culinary, arts and craft, where we showcase that for that weekend. But, just for the sake of saying my DNA is in Africa.
That's beautiful. That's an amazing goal. You bring up sports. Do you see an African nation winning the World Cup in your lifetime?
For sure, yes.
Which countries would you say more likely?
My friend, I see it. I see it very clearly. France would not have won a World Cup if not because of all these African players.
True.
So that's my answer to you.
Well, is there a country you're like?
There will be a country, and there is a country that would better itself, structurally, and eventually will win. Ghana was close, Senegal was close, Nigeria is not far. There's some great teams, some great countries that are, they are going to change the narrative, definitely. And they are going to make it. Yeah. They have made it for, they won it for France.
Yeah.
Twice. Yeah, they just don't like the admits that, it's a bunch of Africans who won the cup for them. But
right.
It's true.
Right.
It's true.
Right.
It's true. France is a little hypocritical about that, but that's fine. But at the end of the day, Those are the boys on stage in Europe, you know. And they go called Monkey as well on top of it. I win a cup for you. I'll make you proud as a nation, but you're still going to, yeah.
What is it in you that has led to your massive success? What is your superpower that you sort of do better than other folks?
I don't know if, or should I say, I feel like the superpower is just the dream we each and every one of us generates out there. You know, it's an energy that we put out. You know, and hopes. You know, dreams and hopes that we put out, and I'm still striving for those dreams. You know. So I guess what I'm saying is that you have to have your dreams clear. You have to have a direction where you want to go and what you want to be tomorrow. Because without a clear understanding, it's like a beautiful yacht, you know, at sea without a captain. It'll roam around. It'll run. Yeah. It'll look amazing until it runs, in circle and hits a wall and then eventually stop.
But to have the clear
but
dream is
you
the
You have to have a direction for it, yes. You have to have a direction and everything is possible. If you could dream it, then you dream it emotionally, then... But sometimes, you know, some of the daily, interaction with family members, friends, and all that, those are the people that keeps you away from your dreams. They don't know they're doing that to you, and you don't know they're doing that to you as well. By, you know, asking too many questions around and, you know, as if you're asking for somebody to, invite you to the dinner table. No, you impose yourself to the dinner table. It's kind of like, look at lions eat in a while. No, a lion don't come to a sign and sort of like, can I join in?
You just jump in.
No. Yeah. You jump in and you get torn apart.
Africa... We don't understand it fully in America.
But you can't understand it fully because, again, it was the goal was for you to not understand it. The goal for us, for us, even Africans, is not to understand it. Let's start from there. It was not made for you to understand. It was made for you to not understand.
Thanks so much to Jaimin for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, Jason Reynolds, Gerville Calais, Michelle Brenda Cox, Kathy F., Dr. Keena Murphy, Earl Dorsey, and Theo Tokas. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Torre Show. And check out my newsletter, Black Minds Matter. Go to blackmindsmatter.substack.com. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garifano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.